Good afternoon, and welcome to Sound Living for this Friday afternoon. I'm Ed Bremmer, and my guest today is Captain Mark Schrader from Stanwood. Captain Schrader has sailed around the world twice, one of them solo. In 2009, he began the adventure that was, in his own words, meaningful and different. It was a 28,000-mile voyage around the Americas to raise awareness of the fragile state of the world's oceans. And we're going to be talking about that voyage, what he saw, what he learned, and what needs to happen if we are going to save this planet and ourselves. And we invite you to join our conversation this afternoon at 425-303-9070. If you'd like to talk with Captain Schrader, if you'd like to talk about his sail around the Americas, if you'd like to talk to him about his solo voyage around the world, you're welcome to call us at 425-303-9070. Captain Schrader, thank you. Welcome for
Delighted to be here.
What is a nice boy like you from Nebraska doing on a sailboat?
Who knows? Who knows? I'm actually an admiral in the Navy for the great state of Nebraska. Yeah, so that was an obviously honor. And it's both circumnavigations were solo.
Were they both? Solo?
Yeah, they were both solo. So
you were the first to solo go past all five of the capes?
All five of the southern capes, which really means it's sometimes hard to identify what those capes are. Everybody knows Cape Horn and Cape Hope in South of Africa, but there's one at the south end of New Zealand, one at Tasmania, and one in Australia. So it really is going around, leaving no land between, you know, the continents and the Antarctic Peninsula.
And did you do that sail that way because no American had ever done it before, or were there another reason?
I didn't actually know that until midway through that no other American had done that, and it wasn't my intent. My intent was to, I had been the executive director of a residential treatment and training facility in North Snohomish County called Victoria Village. Became the Resource Foundation, and I was taking a leave of absence. I'd been sailing out of the Everett community with a good friend, Dr. Irv Varley, from the Everett Clinic. He's passed on, but Irv taught a lot of us how to sail, and that's really where I started thinking about an ocean adventure of my own, and I was going to do this very quietly, leave from here and attempt to sail alone around the world, and if I made it partway, great, and if I made it the whole way, it became a fundraising effort for the Resource Foundation, to make a long story short, and it was pretty successful for the foundation. But it was ambitious trip.
Well, a 64-foot steel-hulled sailboat is a long way from a prairie schooner. when growing up...
I don't know. The answer to your question is I don't know.
Did you feel something missing growing up in landlocked Nebraska that the ocean gave you?
Not that I knew about at the time. I built a boat in Nebraska and put it on the pond. The pond was 3 or 4 feet deep, and the draft of my boat was, I think, 6 feet deep. So I basically had a tower in the middle of the pond.
Sort of like building your boat in your basement.
It was, and so there it is. It's probably still there. I had a great upbringing in Nebraska, and I didn't really know that I was missing anything until my parents decided when I was 16 that my dad was a farmer, college-educated farmer, it was time to get off the farm. He said, and I think there may have been some truth to it, he wanted to leave the farm before I got any more interested in dirt. He was raised in the farm during the Depression, a big farm family. We had a successful operation, and then drought and grasshoppers and a hailstorm for the last 3 years, and he just decided while we had gas money, we're going someplace else. So we went to visit relatives in Santa Barbara, California, and that became home. So when I was 16, we left Nebraska. It was 30 degrees below zero, and all of a sudden there's a beach, there are orange trees, an avocado tree. I knew nothing about avocados. The ocean went clear over the horizon, and gosh, there were girls in bikinis.
Well, I know what you're talking about because I grew up in Illinois and didn't know what was going on until I moved to San Diego.
Ah.
And suddenly I felt like I was home. And when I subsequently lived and spent some time living in Spokane, there was something missing. I need to be close to the ocean.
That happens with me now. Then it was just... discovery. I couldn't imagine that anybody would have difficulty if they grew up with a sandy beach and an ocean. And I saw the ocean I mean, I'd read stories, but probably not so much about discovering the world. I knew more about the moon and the stars and space than I knew about where the ocean went and what it was about and why it was important and all of that. But I came to look at it as a blue highway. And when you look at a map or a globe and you look at that as a blue highway, it opens the universe.
Oh, I want to talk to you more about that perspective a little bit later in the program. We're talking with Captain Mark Schrader, talking about the trip that he did, the sail around the Americas, and we're also going to be talking about some of his solo trips. He made two of them around the world by sailboat. And if you'd like to join the conversation, it's 425-303-9070. Do you remember the first time that you stepped on a sailboat?
I do, and it was, again, it was in California. I worked for a fellow who had an antique store, and he had, after the war, he had built a little double-ended sailboat, 36 feet, and he thought this 16-year-old Nebraska kid should go out and sail. So we sailed to the Channel Islands. I think it was about 30 miles out of Santa Barbara, and went fishing. I can remember catching a bonita after, you know, many years catching bluegills and catfish in Nebraska that are, you know, about as big as your hand. Suddenly, here's something that looks, you know, pretty large and pretty exciting. He introduced me then to other sailors, and when I was 17 during the summer, I hired on as a cook and delivering a sailboat from Santa Barbara to Victoria, B.C., so I got to see the coastline. I didn't know how to sail, and I didn't know how to cook, so that speaks to how desperate they were to have somebody on board. But it suited me well, and I thought, you know, at some point in my life, if I have a chance to do that sort of thing again, I would do it.
No mild de mer?
No, not really. I did discover that in a storm, people do expect the cook to perform, and you do have to, you know, look for things. And when I have to look for things and there's a lot of motion on the boat, I know what my tolerance is pretty well, and if I need air and can get on deck in time. I think everyone probably gets or could get seasick at any time if the conditions are just right or just wrong. But happily, I don't suffer from that easily.
Well, I've seen some, to me, frightening pictures and video from people who transit the Horn. snow, ice, huge waves, huge storms. What about doing that by yourself?
That by yourself can be anxious-making. My first Horn rounding was from the west to the east, so it's going from prevailing winds go from west to east. Currents and waves are going from west to east. The old Cape Horners who went west to east, if you made it around the Horn, the ear next to the Horn, closest to the Horn, you could have pierced, and that was an earring, so you knew that sailor was a Cape Horner. If you went the other way, totally upwind, totally uphill, totally against all of the elements, which we did on Around the Americas, then you earned that earring in the right ear. But the first time around, I'd sailed from Seattle to Cape Horn in 1982 on my first single-handed effort, and for 56 days I was alone approaching the Horn. Sailing south for 56 days really makes you feel like you're sailing off the edge of the world. The seas get gray, they get large, the swells get large, 60, 70 feet, perhaps, big rolling swells. They look like the sand hills in Nebraska, huge things. And then you're coming to a point that you've all read about, and that's Cape Horn, where a wrong move can lead to disaster. So it was anxious-making, but you're so busy when you're by yourself, doing the things that you need to do on the boat, trimming sails, sleeping, eating, making sure everything is right, reading the weather. You really don't think about it until afterwards. And afterwards, maybe a little weak in the knees. But while it's happening, you're really pretty focused on what you're trying to do.
Is it a solo sail really a personal test? Because it's been done before. And so you're not proving that it can be done. So is it more personal?
It's definitely personal. It's well said. It was selfish, in fact. I didn't share that trip with many. I didn't want to be responsible for someone else, frankly, on board. I didn't know if I'd be successful. I didn't know if the whole trip would come to grief. I didn't think it would. I wasn't out there to prove anything or to die trying. I was there to have an adventure and to see what the ocean looked like. I saw a lot of earth and dirt. I wanted to see the ocean, and I hadn't seen much. So that's what was driving me, a curiosity and to learn as much as I could about what's out there. So, and I didn't want to come on watch. I didn't want to come on deck and find that the person that was there with me on this adventure wasn't on board. That happens. I didn't want that experience.
Was it this sail and the other sail that gave you then the confidence to be a captain and be responsible for other crew members?
Well, I've raced a fair amount as a crew on other people's boats and sailed with other people on their boats and had an opportunity to see when someone is in charge of their boat, the captain, how they behave and what things seem to work and what things don't. And this particular trip evolved. The crew were people with whom we had sailed. I had sailed many times, very competent, and there really weren't any issues about, you know, they understood that somebody on a boat needs to be in charge, but everybody on that boat had enough miles to be a professional and knew what to expect. So my job as a captain in that respect was very easy. The hard part of being a captain on the Around the Americas project was just the logistics. I mean, it was 27,000 miles with something like 53 stops in 13 months. So there's a lot of logistics involved in that regard. And unless you have a purser or someone on board to handle all of the ins and outs of different countries and all of that kind of stuff and comings and goings of guest crew, the captain's job really becomes one of, you know, the coordinator.
And this was a crew of three that you had with you?
We were a full-time crew of four on Around the Americas. I knew that we wanted to share the story. We're getting a little ahead of the game here, but we did Around the Americas to highlight the fact that the Americas are an island surrounded by an ocean. We are an island, one ocean. And we wanted to get the message home to anyone who would listen, particularly schools, that it's not a number of different oceans that surround us, it's one. And that ocean has to take all of the abuse that we give it and somehow survive. And that we're all in this together. Everything that happens on this island affects the ocean. And everything that's out there in the ocean affects everyone on this island, whether you realize it or not. So that was the overriding message. In order to tell that story, I wanted to have a writer on board. And I think the best sailing writer today is Herb McCormick. He'd been the editor of Cruising World magazine. He and I happened to be friends because he wrote stories a long time ago about me when I raced around the world in the second circumnavigation. And Herb was writing a book about that. We wanted it documented in images, so we looked for an experienced sailor photographer. And there happened to be one, of all places, from Iowa. I didn't know him. He's younger than I. But he had come to listen to a slideshow that I put on, my goodness, I think in 1984 or 5. He was a very young guy then. He happened to be in the Arctic when we were putting this voyage together, and we spoke by phone, tried to figure out if we could get along together on a boat, and it finally came down to David said, well, Mark, look, I'm from Iowa and you're from Nebraska. We can certainly make this work. And we did. Became good friends.
Let's continue the conversation about the sail around the Americas when we come back from our break. We're talking with Captain Mark Schrader, and we're talking about his sail around the Americas, and we're also going to be talking about another project that he is involved in back to the Northwest Passage. You're welcome to join the conversation this afternoon. Our phone number is 425-303-9070. We'll continue our conversation with Captain Schrader about his sail around the Americas when we come back after this break. We are back on Sound Living this afternoon. We're back with Captain Mark Schrader. We're talking about his trip, sail around the Americas, to call attention to the ailing plight of our world's oceans. And if you'd like to join the conversation, join us at 425-303-9070. Tell me a little bit about the boat, the Ocean Watch, a little bit about
Well, she's 64 feet long, made out of steel. It's not thick steel. We weren't an icebreaker. 3/16 thick steel, which isn't very thick when you're starting to look at icebergs. But, and built in 1988. It wasn't purpose-built for this expedition. It was built by someone else. It had a couple of owners. When we planned this expedition, I talked with people who had been in the Arctic. I'd been around in the southern hemisphere, but nothing in the north, that far north. And it's quite shallow. Surprisingly, the Chukchi and the Bering Sea and everything up there, the polar sea, that's all pretty shallow. There are some bays that...
Shallow is relative.
Well, relative, except that if you have a boat that draws more than 9 or 10 feet, there are lots of little places, harbors and coves and places to hide from the ice you can't get into. So I wanted a fairly shallow draft boat. We shopped a bit and found this boat in Mexico. It was being used by two scientists who were doing mid-ocean dives studying Humboldt squid, living aboard the rest of the time but doing that research. And they appreciated what we were trying to do, and we came to an agreement, brought the boat to Seattle, sailed it up here, and spent a year doing a pretty major refit, something that probably should have taken 2 or 3 years. Did it in a year, a lot of help from the sailing community and maritime community in Ballard and Seattle and up here all over. Lugger Marine donated an engine that had to be repowered. We had communication equipment to put on, scientific instrumentation to put on. But it's a boat that could accommodate a crew of from 5 to 9 people pretty easily. It's not a yacht. It's a workboat, an ocean research vessel. Has a little crane so we could deploy things and pick things up, or they could pluck me out of the water if I fell in. That kind of thing.
It doesn't happen to the captain.
Well, it's happened to some captains, not voluntarily. But we wanted it to be robust. I knew that we would run into things, whether that was in the north or the south. We were going into a lot of ports that don't have sometimes a lot of amenities, and the boat just needed to be pretty stout, and she turned out to be perfect for the job. Absolutely fabulous.
And you left, I believe, in May of 09.
May 31st of 09.
And you went clockwise.
We did.
Up to Alaska,
yes,
and around rather than going with the currents and the tide.
That's right. Exactly. So you joined the ranks of someone who's going to say we went the wrong way, and we did.
I would never say that.
We did. You should say that. We went the wrong way. We went against the prevailing winds and currents the whole way, and there were a couple of reasons for that. The crew committed a year to this project. We all did. It was very possible in the Northwest Passage that you can't make it through in a year. It's only in recent times that it's predictable at all that you can make it through in any kind of time frame. 100 boats in about 100 years have made it through. Most come from the east and go west because there's an area to stage if the passage opens up. The window is July and August, typically. So from Seattle, for instance, you're going north a long time. You're going along around Alaska for quite a long way. We sailed forever, and we were still in Alaska. And you're halfway into the passage before you know if you're going to make it. So halfway in at Cambridge Bay, say, and if you're going to make it, it's the next few days out of Cambridge Bay. And if you can't, you're probably going to spend a year up there because you don't have time to backtrack and get out of the passage. So I wanted that done first, to answer your question. In case we got hemmed in, the trip might have to be cut short. So we went through the passage, came out the other side in September, beginning of September, which is about when you need to be out of there, and then we went south for a long time. We went south from September until January at around Cape Horn.
The Northwest Passage has just recently become transitable. I think you did it in 40 days. Is that right?
I don't know the number of days. It sounds about right. Yeah, that sounds...
Because the Cloud 9 did it in 73 days,
right.
And that was 2 years before
yours.
So you halved that time.
Yep.
Was it because you were luckier, or because in that two-year period of time, global warming had that more sinisterly affected the Northwest Passage and the ice patch?
I can speculate about that. It's hard for me to know, although we did have a very good ice expert who's been studying Arctic ice. He came aboard in Cambridge Bay and went through the rest of it with us. So he's been studying this for a number of years, and I believe, if I'm not misremembering the years, 2008 was the least ice. 2007 and 8 were the least ice years. 2009 was the third least ice years in recorded history. So we moved right along when we could move. We had benefit of satellite communication and internet access most of the time because of the communication gear on board. The Canadian Coast Guard, Canadian Ice Service, are very, very good about giving ice reports, daily ice reports of how the ice is shifting, and we took advantage of that. And I don't know if Cloud 9 had that particular capability. So we moved right along. But the distinction, the passage that we went through, if everybody pulls out their atlas or their map, we stayed very close to the continent, the coastwise.
The big part is the Bering Sea over to the Beaufort Sea.
Right.
And is that the Northwest Passage?
Yes, it's really Arctic Circle to Arctic Circle is by definition the passage. There are a number of passages up there that will be used as the ice melts, which it is doing, and it's been predicted that we'll have completely ice-free summers, certainly by 2050. Ships are being built now to transit one of those passages. We were in a fairly shallow passage. We were in the passage that Amundsen pioneered from 1903 to 1906. Took him 3 years to go from east to west through the Northwest Passage that we traced in whatever that was, 40 days. Took him 3 years. He wintered over in Joa Haven. However, there's a shipping route, a deep water route that will open up and, in fact, has been transited north of where we went. It's a very deep, very wide, has been only accessible by icebreaker until recent times. Big ships will go through there because it's a much more direct passage to Asia from Europe than anywhere else. And you can build a ship that can be huge.
And was that transit of the Northwest Passage, was that during your circling of the Americas the tensest, most nerve-wracking time for you?
I think it was, because we didn't know. We knew that the window was July to September, July and August, really. When we got to Barrow, our plan was to get to Barrow by July 1st and then wait for the ice to release from shore. There's fast ice, which means it's fast to the shore. We'd wait for it to release from the shore and then head east, looking at the ice reports, going to the next cove perhaps. The next might be several days, might be a day, might be a week. And the tension there is the ice is moving all the time. It's driven by current and it's driven by wind. So if the wind changes and the ice starts coming toward you and you don't have somewhere to get out of the way, you'll be driven on shore. That's probably the end of the expedition. So as you're heading into the ice, a lead may open up. Everything is moving. You may go for several miles and discover that that's a dead end. You have to turn around, and when you turn around, everything else has moved. So there were many days of that sort of back and forth, weaving and going through, and sometimes just shutting things off and drifting with the ice until something opened up. So those were the anxious times.
And were you doing scientific evaluations of the ocean along that?
Yes. We had a water sampling pump and device on board that was doing, I think it was taking 13 or 14 different readings of the seawater, from temperature to pH to turbidity to O2 to all kinds of things. That was going 24 hours, 7 days a week. We were also doing some atmospheric data collection. We had on the top of Ocean Watch's mast, which, by the way, was about 80, 85 feet, a platform that, it was about 3 feet square, and it had some very sophisticated collection instruments up there, a couple of radiometers, an inclinometer, a sensitive barometer, all kinds of things up there. That was being recorded and sent back to places that were keeping that data through the University of Washington and the Applied Physics Lab. Most of this data went there. We had a chief scientist on board, Dr. Michael Reynolds, who was in charge of all of that. We had some experiments on there that NASA had asked us to do, and Office of Naval Research and some other acoustic studies, to get data sets, because we were going coastwise where not many other scientific expeditions, if any, had ever gone. So that data is now being analyzed as we speak. It's being used. Some of it's been published in scientific journals. And if we get to do another trip, if we decide to do that and we can find the funding for it, we'll have a comparative data set. But particularly in South America, I mean, we were measuring this 24 hours, 7 days a week along the coast for 27,000 miles. Nobody's ever done that.
And the data that you collected, as you looked at that data, as you looked at the ocean, were you discouraged by what you were discovering on that, as to the health of the ocean?
I have to be anecdotal about that, because I had never collected the scientific data. I'd spent a lot of time on the ocean in my years and miles on the ocean. So I know what I've seen on the ocean in terms of what you can see is sometimes horrible, but it's what you can't see that really is the problem. You can't see ocean acidification with the naked eye. You've got to do some measurements, and acidification is causing some huge problems. But let me answer your first question first. We saw a lot more plastic and debris and just crud in the ocean than any of us have ever seen before. A number of experienced sailors on board who spent a lot of time out there, and particularly in South America and some ports in South America and on the west coast of Mexico and the west coast of U.S., and in all places in Miami. The port and harbor in Miami was absolutely filthy. So that's what you can see. But in a lot of cases, it's what you can't see that's even worse.
And a lot of that is out there is plastic, as I understand
it. A huge amount of it is plastic. Plastic pollution is just somebody said that the big gyre in the North Pacific was discovered in 1990-91. Well, David Logan, the mate on Ocean Watch, a good friend, he and I sailed back from Hawaii, I think it was in 1986.
Is that the garbage island?
The garbage island. It's just the area. Because of the flow of currents, there's a little bit of a whirlpool effect there, and anything that gets dumped in the ocean in the Pacific side ends up in this area. We sailed through islands of debris, and we sort of joked to each other that it really hadn't been necessary for us to provision in Maui or Hawaii, wherever it was, to come back. We could have collected anything we needed right there in the middle, from lawn chairs to frisbees to footballs to you name it. It was there, and we went sort of from little island to little island, and each little island becomes an ecosystem, but it's usually attached to debris, plastic. Plastic goes away after a while, but the problem with plastic is as it degrades, it becomes more toxic. And it ends up in little micron particles, and those little micron particles are eaten by everything you and I like to eat. So fish out there are ingesting that at a great rate.
Well, I've got a notation from an organization called Save the Sea. Plastic waste kills 1 million seabirds and 100,000 sea mammals and countless fish each year.
You know, the sad part about that is that's preventable. That's human behavior that can change. We're all capable of changing. We can all do better. We can all use less plastic. We're hoping that the plastic technology changes to a point where, you can actually have something that is biodegradable and doesn't leave a toxic stain. So we're hoping that that happens. But in the meantime, plastic, particularly in a lot of other countries, ends up being thrown in stream beds and washes and dumps that when it rains, that just all gets washed out to sea.
And this was part of, or if not the incentive for this trip, to sail around, to demonstrate that the Americas are an island, and to demonstrate that the ocean is in bad and getting worse shape.
Absolutely. And to bring home the fact that we live here in Seattle, and we have Puget Sound problems and all that kind of thing, but because of ocean currents, what happens up here eventually will happen someplace else or will affect someplace else. People in South America need to be pretty concerned about what all of us living north of the equator are doing to the ocean, because eventually it pollutes the water everywhere. So there's no getting away from that. It's one ocean.
I get the feeling in conversation with you that whereas most of us, and maybe even a lot of folks in Nebraska even, but most of us would say we live on land near the ocean, but you would like to shake that concept up and have us take a look from another direction.
I think I'm absolutely convinced from the time we've been able to spend with scientists and the access we had to institutions who are studying the ocean all the way around the Americas, from great places in Halifax, Dalhousie, and from places in Florida and California and in South America, people who are studying what's happening to the marine ecosystem. We've been party to those conversations and have had scientists on board. It's been graduate school. We're all connected to the ocean, and that ocean is keeping us alive. It doesn't matter if we're living in Iowa or Ohio or Nebraska or wherever. That our ocean needs to be healthy, or the rainfall changes dramatically, the food that we eat, the food chains change dramatically. All of this stuff is connected. I guess if there's one message there, until fairly recently, when I looked at the ocean, I saw what I'm guessing most people see. It's gorgeous. The top of it looks just terrific. What could possibly be wrong with it? And it's so huge, how could we as little people have any effect on it? Well, when you look below that surface, and kids now in elementary schools and junior high schools are starting to study the ocean in different ways, they see the connections. They see that a healthy ocean means that we have an opportunity to live healthy lives.
We tend to forget that the Earth is 71% water, and I think 97% of our water is in the ocean.
That's right. But here's the thing that's really difficult to grasp, and I don't know on the radio if I can do justice to it. So pretend that the world is a basketball. You have that in your mind, and 70% of the surface is covered by water. Scrape all of that water off, everything. Salt water, fresh water, glaciers, ponds, every bit of water and ice on this planet. Scrape it off and put it in a balloon and put it next to the basketball that you've decided is Earth and decide how big that amount of water is in that balloon. And it would be about the size of a silver dollar. That's all the water there is. Compared to the water on Earth is onion skin thin. We talked about how thin it is in the Arctic, maybe 20 feet. But relatively speaking, it's very, very, very thin. So that little silver dollar size balloon is where we're dumping everything. It has to absorb everything, that all of the runoff, all of the plastic, all of the carbon, everything. And it has done a terrific job of absorbing that and cleaning it. And I'm surprised it's not in worse shape than it is. The other, as we've talked about that, you take the air, the atmosphere, from 30,000 feet down and compress it, bring it down to sea level, and do the same thing, stuff it in a balloon, so we can see actually how much air we have as humans to deal with. And it's not much bigger than that silver dollar. So all of the stuff that we gas off into the atmosphere, we just sort of take for granted it goes away. The atmosphere is big. What could possibly be bad? Just goes into that relatively tiny area. That graphic, I would hope, can go into schools. It's not political. It's what it is. Here's how big the Earth is. Here's how much water we have. And we're 7 billion people. Now, to argue that 7 billion people and the industry that we have doesn't contribute to the pollution that goes into that water and that air seems silly to me. We didn't used to have 7 billion people. When I was in high school, when I graduated from high school, there were 3.5 billion of us. Now there are 7. So,
we're talking on Sound Living this afternoon with Captain Mark Schrader, talking about his sail around the Americas. We're going to continue our conversation. You're welcome to join us at 425-303-9070. We'll take a short break, and then we will continue our conversation this afternoon on Sound Living with Captain Mark Schrader. And we are back on Sound Living this afternoon. We're talking with Captain Mark Schrader about his sail around the Americas. And if you'd like to join the conversation, 425-303-9070. About 80% of the world's population live within 60 miles of the ocean. About three-quarters of the world's really big mega cities are located by the ocean. But many people would say man over the centuries managed to tame the land and bend it to our will. The ocean remains out of our control regardless of technology. Do you think that has anything to do with our sense of the ocean is unmanageable, so let's just use it as a waste dump? We can't tame it, so...
I'm not even sure that it is... I don't know to answer the question specifically. I think a lot of this is because we don't talk about our oceans in school. We don't talk about why they're important. There's an organization that studies
this. It seems funny because 90% of all of the produce, all of the goods that we consume travel by ocean.
That's right. And but that's how we see it. We talk about that as the transportation. We talk about it as recreation. But we don't talk about how important it is in other respects. We don't really talk about what's happening in the food chain. We don't talk about what happens when something is overfished here, and suddenly jellyfish start showing up in huge, huge numbers, and they're big in other places. We haven't talked about those things. Somebody said the other day, and I can't give you specifically where it came from, but there aren't any marine science questions on college entrance exams. So ocean, you know, ocean studies haven't been a big deal unless your teacher in high school or junior high or elementary school is interested in it and gets you down to the beach, or if you happen to be in, you know, pick a state in the Midwest. You need to study what happens when something goes down the Missouri or Mississippi River and what the oceans are doing in terms of climate in the Midwest. So I think it's a matter of we just haven't paid attention to it, and I think education can change that.
Well, as part of the your sail around the Americas, you made, I think you said, 57 stops?
53 stops.
53
yeah.
stops. Were those planned stops that you had set out in advance, and did you use this opportunity to speak with the people who were living that close to the ocean?
We had an agreement from the beginning that from the sailors, our mission here was to share what we were seeing and hearing and talking about with as many people who would listen. It wasn't a political agenda. It was getting stories from people, particularly in the North, and sharing them with other people. Climate change in the North isn't a political issue. It's a fact of life. Overfishing in the Southern Hemisphere, in Chile, fish farming, you know, major disasters in all kinds of places down there. It's a fact of life. So what our mission was to share these stories as we run around. So, yes, most of the stops, the 53 stops, most of them were planned. Some were an accident. But we would set up a display. We had a tent on board that explained the scientific instrumentation aboard Ocean Watch, who the crew was, what we were trying to do. It was in Spanish and English. We didn't have a budget or time to translate it into Inuit or Portuguese. That would have been good. And we then visited schools, invited kids to come down to the boat, parents to come down to the boat. We gave public presentations in a great majority of those stops. I think there were 3,500 children that came aboard the boat or came for a visit. I don't know how many thousand came to presentations around. When we arrived in a port, it was time to work. It was time to share the story, get people aboard, show them the boat, talk about what the science means, and then go sailing again to the next port.
And did you find an empathy with your message from the communities that you visited?
We really did. A number of things happened. We're all living in pretty close quarters on Ocean Watch. You know, it's a long trip. And sometimes we'd start to get a little bit stale, and it was the community and the kids who renewed us in many cases. Their enthusiasm for what we were doing, you know, helped us and kept us going in some in some cases. The message was well received. In the North, we were met with some suspicion that we might be part of a more radical, politicized organization, and we're there to tell them that they can't do subsistence hunting anymore, or they can't do this, or they've ruined their world, or something on that. And we weren't. We were collecting stories. And once people understood that we didn't have that political agenda, they opened up, remarkably opened up, and we learned a lot.
And did, in terms of North America versus South America, the United States, which is mostly North America, was there a different approach, a different attitude toward what you were doing in the North American ports that you visited as opposed to the ports in South America?
I'd have to say that generally speaking, and maybe it's because of the ports that we picked, there was sort of less interest and less enthusiasm unless we put a lot of effort into advertising what it was we were doing. There was less enthusiasm along the U.S. shorelines than there was in South America and in Canada and in the North. And that may be just because we were competing with lots of other things that happen in those big cities and communities. We were well received in New York and had an entree to schools, a lot of New York schools, as we did in other places. But the question was, the feeling was in South America, you'd come into a port and we were inviting people to come aboard and participate in something that they'd never experienced before. Most of these kids had never, unless their parents had a boat, never been invited to come down on the dock to get on something like Ocean Watch and to hear what it was we were doing. The teachers were ecstatic. They were very enthusiastic.
We're talking with Captain Mark Schrader, and we've got a call. If you'd like to join the conversation this afternoon, our phone number is 425-303-9070. And joining us this afternoon from Smoky Point is Sean. Sean, thanks for joining us. Are you with us?
Yeah, okay. I got it.
Doing fine. Thanks for joining us.
I was wondering if you're familiar with that 600 square mile eddy of plastic bits in the Pacific.
Thanks, Sean. Yes, I am. I haven't been out there recently, but a number of years ago, I've traveled through that area. There are actually areas like that in other places, in other oceans. There's one in the Indian Ocean, there's one in the Atlantic. And because of the technology now of looking at things from space, they're discovering these little eddies of plastic and garbage in a number of places.
I think that's called the Great Pacific Garbage Island, I think.
That's right, the Gyre, yes.
As I understand it, that's getting into the food chain. I was just thinking if anyone with the means ever wanted to deal with that, relatively easy remedy would be to use those skims that were used in the Gulf oil spill.
It's a good suggestion. The problem with the one in the Pacific is it's about the size of Texas. I mean, it depends on where the currents are and what's happening, and it's a very, very large area. So, it would be possible with perhaps to net some of it or to skim some of it, but it is such an overwhelmingly large area. And it does become a problem for the food chain because as the plastic breaks down, you know, it's gobbled up by things that we're eating.
Sean, I appreciate your call this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you, Ed. Bye.
Sean from Smoky Point joining us this afternoon on Sound Living. And if you'd like to join the conversation, it's 425-303-9070. Returning to the stops that you made, the school kids that you spoke with, the teachers, the classes that you got into, did you get a sense, particularly in the South American nations, that you were having a lasting impact, that they might think twice before they toss that plastic bottle of soft drink into their river, that maybe they would think before doing that?
Oh, I have to hope that. I mean, I'm an optimist. I think that everyone who came aboard Ocean Watch took a little something away with that experience, that the ocean is a valuable and fragile place, and it's keeping us alive. But moreover, I'm excited about thinking that you never know who the next great oceanographer or, you know, marine scientist is going to be. You just don't know. You don't know who the Cousteau might be. And I've got to think that in the kids that we saw on this effort and the ones who we connected with through schools or on the website, there are ones who have decided to make marine science their life's work.
I was wondering about your optimism, because I remember, as I mentioned, I grew up in Illinois, and I remember watching the Jacques Cousteau specials on mm-hmm. television. And here we are 40 years later, 50 years later, we don't seem to be any smarter about what Jacques Cousteau was saying 50 years ago.
No, we need a lot more Jacques Cousteaus. We need education through adventure captures the imagination of all of us, I think. And I think we need more of that. We learn from that.
You're working on another project, the Northwest Passage 2012?
We'd like to do is revisit this route and actually resail this route going the right way. So leaving Seattle and going south around Cape Horn the right way and going up the other side and getting a comparative data set. This time the crew would be a little different, a lot more teachers, high school science sorts of things. I'd like to have more kids involved, and I'd like to have people from different countries join the expedition, either on board briefly or perhaps with another boat. I think the more attention we can bring to particularly ocean and coastwise ocean issues, the better we're all going to be. And it's something that I feel like I can do and would like to do, and I think there's value to it.
And with the technology that has evolved since you made your original voyage, Skype and Internet
oh, yes.
and whatnot, you could take the classroom right with you.
You can take the classroom and you can do it like Ed Bob Ballard did with the JASON project. And there have been several, you know, some space projects the same way. We can get this into classrooms all over the place. We had some just hilarious moments trying to find Internet connections in Brazil or Uruguay or Argentina so that we could connect with schools in Iowa and Illinois and Nebraska and California through distance learning projects. And those schools were very excited to be voiced aboard Ocean Watch and to be getting our daily reports.
What about Internet connections in the Northwest Passage? Were you successful?
We were successful, and we actually wrote a little book, and we did this in the North. And sent it out via a very slow Internet connection. I think it was in Pond Inlet. We were all trying to get it done so that the book would be done by the time we got to Halifax or Boston.
Is the book available?
This little book was just something we published, self-published. Our book called One Island, One Ocean will come out at the end of November. Thanks for asking. It's published by Weldon Owen in San Francisco, and it is a coffee table meaty book. I think it's now about 50,000 words, more than 100 images, and it tells the story of Ocean Watch and crew. I've just finished proofing it. Herb McCormick wrote the majority of it, and I think it's fabulous. I think it is. I don't think I've seen a book quite like it.
And where is Northwest Passage 2012? Are you looking to raise funds? Is that what you're looking at for it? Is there a web page for Northwest Passage 2012?
I see you with your checkbook out here on the table. And I could, this is the 2012 expedition is, at this point, me talking about it to companies and potential sponsors of it and contributors to it. I think it has value. I think Seattle's Pacific Science Center would like to be involved, as would the Seattle Aquarium. And if we can form a consortium of that, along with some companies who are interested in helping support the effort, it'll happen.
And would it be northwestpassage2012.org, I think?
It would be aroundtheamericas.org, and you can go to aroundtheamericas.org to get updates on any of this and updates on the book. And on aroundtheamericas.org are a lot of the images and a lot of the stories from the 2009-2010 effort.
Captain Schrader, thank you for coming in today. It's been
my pleasure.
Thrilling to talk with you.
Thank you. I love sharing the story. Thanks for your interest.
You've been listening to Sound Living. I'm Ed Bremmer, and my guest today has been Captain Mark Schrader. We've been talking about his sail around the Americas and the fragile state of the world's oceans. And again, it is aroundtheamericas.org if you are looking for additional information. Next week on Sound Living, my guest will be Dave Brooks, Chief Executive of the Providence Hospital in North Everett. They've had their open house, and they are open for business. Get answers to your questions about this new 14-story building in the heart of North Everett's neighborhood next week here on Sound Living. Join the conversation with Dave Brooks, Chief Executive Officer of Providence Hospital, next Friday on Sound Living from Independent Public Radio, KSER. Sound Living is a production of the News and Public Affairs Department of your Independent Public Radio station, made possible with engineering help this week from Wandering Joel, and we'd like to hear your thoughts and suggestions for future topics. Email your comments and suggestions to news@kser.org or send us a note to KSER 2623 Wetmore in Everett. I'm your host, Ed Bremmer. Thank you for listening to Sound Living here on KSER. We'll be right back.